Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals Council. You will each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask that you please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral argument, and please feel free to adjust the podium to suit your height needs.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Colin Pastorski on behalf of Appellant Mary Brown. The question before this court is whether the lower courts vacating the default judgment in this matter was an abuse of discretion. For the reasons that I'll argue today and for the reasons that are further articulated in the briefing, the answer to this question, with all due respect to the lower court, is a resounding yes. I intend to focus my argument today on two of the four Findon factors. Those two factors are the reasonable excuse and the due diligence factors. But before I get into those two factors, I think it is important to discuss the Findon case generally and also discuss the important facts that are at play here. The Findon case does acknowledge that there is a liberal policy to having a trial heard on the merits, but it's also important to recognize that that liberal policy only extends so far to circumstances in which it was the attorney's neglect or the attorney's mistake that resulted in the default judgment. This policy has been reiterated in dozens of cases in the 50-plus years since Findon has been decided. Here, MSP is not the innocent party that is contemplated by the Findon case. And there are multiple undisputed facts in the record that demonstrate this. One, MSP failed to answer the complaint, and there's no dispute that it was properly served. Two, they refused to engage the legal system after it was served with the complaint, despite service of countless motions and countless notice of motions.
Has there been any allegation that they didn't receive notices of these court proceedings that were going on?
No, there has been no allegation of that. In fact, the court's finding said that defendant was served with each of these notices. MSP also failed to disclose assets. And in fact, there is evidence that MSP took steps to hide assets from collections. And it is also undisputed that MSP only decided to participate in this process after Brown's counsel notified MSP's counsel that it learned of the hidden assets that was discovered. Given the facts in this record, it clearly establishes that it was MSP's ignorance, willful ignorance even, that resulted in the default judgment against it. Therefore, it was an abuse of discretion for the court to vacate the judgment under this record. For the reasonable excuse factor, the question is whether MSP established a reasonable excuse for failing to answer the complaint.
All right. I just want to stop you. What is our standard of review? The overall finding, I assume, is an abuse of discretion because whether there's a vacation under the rule is a discretionary call by the court.
Correct. That is correct. And I acknowledge that it is an abuse of discretion, and the court does have broad discretion in determining each of these factors. However, the court does not have unlimited discretion, and that's been acknowledged in various cases as well. The court can abuse its discretion if, for example, the underlying facts are clearly erroneous, if it misapplies the law, or if it resolves a case in a manner in which is clearly contrary to logic. And I believe all of those circumstances are present in this case. Right. For the reasonable excuse factor, the court made a finding that MSP failed to communicate its misunderstandings or otherwise intended any hearings. That in and of itself shows that MSP does not have a reasonable excuse for its failure to answer the complaint. But there are two ways in which the court's finding that MSP met the reasonable excuse factor was an abuse of discretion. First, the court failed to conduct the proper analysis that is required of it. Second, it found against a rule that was held by this court that the pro se status alone of MSP was sufficient to meet the reasonable excuse factor.
Well, didn't the court find that MSP alleged that Schaefer, the CEO or manager of MSP, alleged that he didn't understand that he was supposed to respond to the answer and misunderstood the scheduling order? And why aren't those facts sufficient for finding a reasonable excuse. Why did the court abuse its discretion?
Sure. I think there's two things there. First, the court didn't consider that. The court's conclusions of law for the reasonable excuse factor said that MSP failed to communicate its misunderstandings. I know that MSP had an excuse that it put forth, that the scheduling order that was issued was an excuse. However, it can lob as many excuses as it wants to the court, but the excuse has to be reasonable. The court did not buy this excuse, and it's that's delineated in its conclusions of law that said MSP failed to communicate its misunderstandings. Beyond that, I think it's articulated in the briefing as well.
Well, even if it failed to communicate its understandings, can't that still be a reasonable excuse if that's the basis for its failing to act?
Correct, and it doesn't, like, the judge's order does not talk about that, their excuse. I mean, their findings of fact to the reasonable excuse. And when you look at the record, it just doesn't make sense that this excuse could fly with any court, and it didn't fly with this court. It didn't articulate that fact, at least. MSP, like I said, their excuse that they put forth to the district court was that it received a scheduling order on June 15th, so it's assumed that it didn't have to do anything till a trial date, which is sometime in 2018 or 2019.
And when was the deadline to file an answer?
That beforehand, I believe it was.
What I thought.
Yes, so. April. So that's one part. It was served with the complaints and summons that specifically articulated the obligations and responsibilities that MSP had. And it had to respond to the complaint within 20 days. That's on the first page of the summons. It's bold and it's in capital letters. And an MSP acknowledges that it received service of the complaint. And the deadline to answer that complaint was well over a month prior to the service of the scheduling order. So it just doesn't make sense that he could use that as an excuse for failure to answer the complaint, because the deadline already passed. And beyond that, prior to the service of the scheduling order, MSP was served with the motion for entry of default judgment. And MSP acknowledged service of that motion in an email to Brown's counsel and said that he thought that this matter was resolved and he was going to get an attorney to resolve this. The reality is...
And what was the date of that email?
June 9th, 2017, Your Honor. And the reality is, as of June 9th, 2017, MSP did not have any counsel. At least that's what the record reflects. The record reflects that MSP did not have counsel until November, months and months and months after the fact.
Well, you're not arguing on this reasonable excuse that the court got it wrong, because the court basically said the defendant has not made a strong showing. So... I mean, so we know it's a weak factor in favor of the movement here.
And respectfully, I don't even think it is a weak showing. He made no showing of reasonable excuse. And that goes to my second point for the pro se status. There's been no case that I'm aware of, there's been no case that MSP has cited and that go for the position that his misunderstanding alone or his pro se status alone is sufficient enough to establish a reasonable excuse. I mean, there is just no, it's either he met the reasonable excuse factor or he didn't. It's not that he made a weak showing. The court acknowledged that he failed to communicate his misunderstandings. And that combined with the fact that pro se status of a litigant has not been found to be in and of itself a reasonable excuse is an abuse of discretion in this case. Now, even if there were such a case that a pro se status of a litigant was sufficient enough to establish an excuse, I don't think there is, but I would suggest to the court that this case would be different from that case because, as I just argued, MSP knew of its obligations to act at the very outset of this case. It was served with a summons and complaint. It acknowledged service of the summons and complaint, understanding that it had to answer, and completely disregarded the summons and complaint, did not want to participate in the legal system. It wasn't that he didn't read it. It wasn't that he didn't understand English. He wasn't incapacitated. He received it. He just chose not to respond.
And those comments you're making there are reference to cases that have held that in conjunction with a pro se?
Correct.
Okay.
So in terms of his pro se status until he retains counsel in November, what case would you say is most on point in terms of examining whether there's a reasonable excuse or not?
I think the Black v. Rimmer case is the most on point, and I might be beating a dead horse at this point after reading the briefing, but I do think the Black v. Rimmer is directly on point with respect to this court's previous analysis on the reasonable excuse factor as it relates to a party's pro se status. They said the only way by which we can conclude that a movement has a reasonable excuse for his failure to act is by adopting a rule that would allow a pro se defendant to ignore the proper procedures and wait until the plaintiffs have gone through the expense and effort to prove liability and damages, after which the movement could respond and claim that he or she has a reasonable excuse to failure to act. That's exactly, I think, the circumstance that we have here, Your Honors. And even though the Black v. Rimmer Court refused to adopt such a rule, the lower court, in disregard of this rejection of the rule, adopted that very rule. And that was an abuse of discretion. I want to shift gears into the due diligence factor now. This rule, the rule in this factor requires that a court determine whether a movement acted with due diligence after learning of its error.
Well, and I want to get right to it, because here the court made an interesting finding that the defendant was not diligent, but the attorney was when he finally hired the attorney. Is this a misapplication of the law, or is this another fact that we are to consider, whether there's sufficient evidence in the record?
Right. Thank you, Arthur. I would argue that that is both a misapplication of the law and a decision on the facts that are clearly erroneous to what's in the record. For the due diligence factor, it is odd that he separates the conduct of the party itself and the conduct of the attorney. I don't think that's the right analysis that a court is supposed to provide. The correct analysis that the court is supposed to implicate in this reasonable excuse factor is the court is supposed to review the entire catalog of events. It's not supposed to limit its inquiry to just this is the date that this he knew of its obligation to act, and this is the date when he finally decided to act.
Well, but isn't it important to separate the two, because if the action... Because generally courts will excuse delay caused by lawyers versus delay caused by the person. So isn't that an important aspect of it to take into account?
Possibly, Your Honor, and I think it does go. I think the fit-in factors, as like I said, fit-in is supposed to excuse the errors of an attorney. And when you take that policy and apply it to the due diligence factors, the fit-in factors aren't supposed to excuse the errors for the attorney's diligence. It shouldn't excuse the due diligence of the lack of diligence for the party itself. Here, MSP knew of its error as of June 9, 2017. And I think that this is what's different in the findings of fact. The court makes a finding of fact that the defendant knew of its obligation to act in September 25th, 2017. I believe that's in paragraph 19 of its findings of fact. That's just contrary to what's in the record, because prior to that, in the paragraphs preceding that finding, the court acknowledges that MSP was served with repeated motion after motion after motion.
But counsel, there wasn't a default judgment entered until July 13th. That was the date of the order granting entry of default judgment, and judgment was made and notice served. So wouldn't that be the earliest date for purposes of analyzing the due diligence factor, which requires us to look at whether the party acted with due diligence after notice of entry of the judgment?
I don't think so, and there's some conflicting law on this, actually, Your Honor. If you look at the Colby Woodski case, it's a Supreme Court, I think it was decided in 2016, it said the due diligence factor requires a movement to...
What's the cite to that case?
It's Colby Woodski.
Okay, sorry.
And it's 884 Northwestern 2D 634, and I think the page site is 637.
Well, except I'm just looking at the judge's order here, and it does say the third Fendon factor, due diligence, is measured by asking if a party was diligent, and then there's a quote from a case after notice of entry of judgment, and it's citing to one of our cases, actually, Valley View versus Schutte.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I acknowledge that there's a difference in how you want to apply it. I mean, Colby Woodski is a Supreme Court of Minnesota case that came out in 2016. So I would suggest that their analysis of the due diligence factor is precedential, in that it requires you to look at due diligence from the timing of it learned of its error. I mean, that's when it makes sense. I mean, you get, you analyze when something before the due date for the complaint happened, and then after you learned of your mistake that you failed to answer the complaint was.
So would this be an error of law?
I think so. And it also, I think it doesn't really matter. I mean, it's either June or July 2017. I mean, months and months and months went by, and he still didn't retain an attorney, even though he knew of its obligation to act. He retained an attorney in November of 2017, still did not actually adequately move to vacate the default judgment until January of 2018. That is not diligent. And the court actually agrees with me on this point that MSP was not diligent, but then it substitutes MSP's lack of diligence with the attorney's diligence, and that the attorney's, the way that the attorney acted within 2 months or so was diligent.
Is that an error of law?
I believe so. Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
And how would you articulate the law that was not followed here?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it was an error of law because the fit-in factors generally, like I said, are supposed to look at the conduct of the party itself and determine whether the conduct was willful or not and whether the conduct establishes willfulness. Here it does, and the court failed to look at the party's own actions and instead excused MSP and gave MSP a pass in this case. I see my time is up. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Rose, and I represent MSP in this matter. The standard of review here, Your Honors, are a clear abuse of discretion, and you have to give deference to the court's order and view the order in the light most favorable to the order. Whether to grant a motion to vacate is within the sound discretion of the trial court. And he applied the very law that they've cited in this case to the facts that presented to him at oral argument and contemplated those facts, applied the law, and made his ruling. And he made his ruling that all four Findon factors were established, albeit the reasonable excuse one was weak. Now, with respect to I'll start with the defense. There is no debate here that MSP has asserted reasonable defenses on liability and damages.
Well, that factor's not in dispute, though, right?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, they say it is in dispute. They say that there wasn't a strong showing on whether a debatably meritorious defense exists, and that for somehow that linguistic argument somehow defeats the fact that this Findon factor has been met.
Well, what about the Wyckoff case? I mean, it seems like that's the biggest hurdle or the biggest case that you need to deal with, which is a strong showing on two factors is insufficient to overcome a weak showing on the other two. And here we have a weak showing on reasonable excuse. But we also, I mean, that due diligence is also maybe a weak factor because we have an absolute finding by the court that your client was not diligent. Is that, and so, I mean, so aren't we in this Wyckoff situation where we have we have two weak factors and maybe arguably two strong factors?
No.
And why not?
I would argue, and I do argue, Your Honor, that the due diligence, if you look at the Imperial case, identifies that it doesn't matter what events that you look at, whether you agree with them or not, if the motion came within 3 months, of the time frame, since this court has already said 3 months is quick enough, that the due diligence factor is met.
I don't think the case law, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't think the case law is that clear that it's a strict timeline issue.
You're right.
You have to look at the totality of the circumstances.
You're absolutely right. There is no hard and fast rule with respect to how long you have to bring the judgment or the motion to vacate after the judgment's entered. You have a one-year time limit set out by the rule, and the circumstances when the motion comes kind of depends on the flavor of the case, and it's a case-by-case individual analysis. Here, he's a pro se litigant who can't be a pro se litigant because it's a company. He gets this judgment, and within 2 months, contacts our office, and within a month, month and a half, we bring the motion. So,
go ahead.
Can you specify what dates you're talking about? Because I think the time frame was much longer than 2 months. The default judgment was entered on July 13th, and your office wasn't retained until November 8th, is my understanding. Is that correct? When was your office retained?
It was November of 2017.
You don't have an exact date.
I think it was November 7th, 8th, around that
time frame. November 7th, 8th. Okay, and are you disputing that the default judgment was entered on July 13th?
There was a finding of default in July, and then there was a hearing in August that set the amount of the judgment.
Of the damages.
Of the damages.
And that was, that order was,
that was August
docketed
24th.
And served on August 24th, correct?
So there's a default judgment in July and no, I have a more basic question. When did MSP have an attorney? Was it as of June 9th, 2017 or November? Because it seems, MSP seems to imply that it had counsel and that it had talked to counsel and had understood that this case was dismissed, that this case wasn't proceeding any further.
Another demonstration of not knowing what he's doing. He thought he had an attorney involved. Apparently, he did not. His understanding of whatever retention or whatever role that attorney was playing didn't match his understanding.
But this is somebody who is very familiar with the legal process. This isn't somebody who has been hailed into court for the first time.
Well, this is the first time he's been hailed into district court. All his understanding of the legal process is in housing court and conciliation court, in which he can participate by himself.
Didn't he have a default judgment entered against him personally?
There was a credit card case out there of a very nominal amount that he had no idea about and paid it off once it was discovered, I think, during a financing matter.
But the complaint clearly said that an answer was required. Is that correct?
I don't dispute the summons. The Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have acknowledged that pro se people have a hard time understanding what they're supposed to do when they get a summons and a complaint.
Well, let's get back to the due diligence. The district court expressly found that defendant was not diligent himself after receiving notice of the judgment in August. So that would be of the damages order, because that was after the default judgment itself. And so the district court made an express finding that the party here was not diligent. So isn't that inconsistent with the Findon factors? Because to satisfy the Findon factor, you have to find that the party acted with due diligence after learning of the judgment or after learning of the error or omission. Why isn't that an abuse of discretion to find that due diligence factor is met after the district court expressly found that the party hadn't acted with due diligence?
If anything, it's a harmless error, Your Honor.
How is it a harmless error?
Because he rectified it by finding that through counsel he became
diligent.
But
that's different, and that goes to the point I was discussing with your opposing counsel, is there is a difference, and the courts have recognized a difference between diligence by the party and diligence by the attorney. And courts are willing to excuse a lack of diligence by attorney so a party doesn't get punished. But the Findon factor specifically focuses on the conduct of the party. And the district court's order specifically said that MSP, quote, was not diligent himself. So how is this factor even met?
because the Imperial case says it doesn't really matter what you look at as long as it's within the time frame, a reasonable time frame of when the judgment came in.
But the judge already said that he was not diligent, that the company, that your client was not diligent. And the Imperial case doesn't set a strict 3-month time frame, but even if it was 3 months, I think, you know, arguably it's more than 3 months here.
Well, I believe he was diligent. I think the court got it wrong on that small aspect of it. He's a pro se litigant. The case law that's been cited identifies that pro se litigants are afforded a accommodation, some leniency to act. Here, he was a pro se litigant who couldn't act on his own to begin with.
But on that point of pro se litigants, a couple of things. One, there's also a case law saying pro se litigants are held to the same standard as attorneys in court. And second, you reference in your brief, you reference, you know, 126 years of case law on findings, motions to vacate and dismissals. Can you cite to any case law that supports the proposition that the finding of a pro se litigant by itself, that factor by itself, is sufficient to meet this factor, this Finden factor? So all the case law I've seen is pro se in conjunction with something else, with some other delay or some type of challenge or roadblock that the person faced. But can you cite to any case law that says a finding that a pro se litigant alone is enough to meet that factor?
I can't, Your Honor. All I can say is that there's case law out there that allows leniency to accommodate the pro se litigant, and that sometimes rules can be bent, especially procedural rules. And this is what we're talking about, is a procedural rule as to when to answer.
Do those cases apply to the due diligence factor or the reasonable excuse factor? Because they're two different factors. So can you point me to a case that talks about that pro se litigants should be given leniency in regards to the due diligence factor?
Well, there isn't a case on point that I can point you to with respect to that. But what I can tell you is that in this situation, they were a corporate defendant. He couldn't come to the court and do anything himself. He had to retain a lawyer. So what he did
correct me if I'm wrong, but you're saying he didn't retain a lawyer until November 7th.
Right,
so
which was
and
within.
Shouldn't we consider that in the due diligence analysis?
Yes, within 2 months of receiving the judgment, the final judgment, he acted and did so in a manner in which he would be able to do something with the court.
So isn't it true that he really didn't act until there was an attempt to garnish? There was a garnishment summons and subpoena served. Wasn't that really the triggering event here?
He got the a garnishment, yes. He didn't understand why he was being garnished or how a judgment happened, again, not understanding the process.
Doesn't he have an obligation to consult with an attorney? I guess I'm confused as to why it took him so long to consult an attorney in this case, if you can help me understand that.
All I can tell you, Your Honor, is that he was relying on his normal course dealing in housing court and conciliation court where he could handle it himself. And he didn't understand that he couldn't represent himself in this particular case.
But he really didn't take any steps to represent himself either. Is that true?
Well, he got the scheduling order and thought that was the time frame in which he had to adhere to, and that's what he was working towards.
After he got the scheduling order, that was in the middle of June, there was a default judgment entered, and then there was a judgment establishing the damages. So at that point, it should have been clear that that scheduling order was no longer in effect.
Well, all I could, again, ignorant to the procedural process, Your Honor. By August 24th, he was looking for a lawyer. He landed in our office, and we took action.
By August 24th?
No. August 24th, he took action. I'm assuming he was looking for somebody, but
is there evidence in the record of that?
There is not.
What about, can you cite to any case law stating that pro se status alone can be sufficient for the reasonable excuse factor?
Well, that would be the the accommodation leniency cases of Glavovich.
Those are general cases. I'm talking specific cases focusing on the Findon factors. And in particular, we've talked about due diligence. What about reasonable excuse? Is there any case law that says pro se status alone is enough to meet the reasonable excuse factor?
When you say pro se status alone, meaning?
Well, there's cases out there that do acknowledge a pro se status, but they acknowledge it in conjunction with other issues that face that pro se litigant.
You're talking about the mental impediments and the lack of language, things like that.
Yeah, language barriers. There's case law about older gentlemen who just, you know, I don't remember, 75, 85 years old, situations like that where you, but here you've got somebody who, there isn't anything that I can see other than the citation of the fact that he's pro se.
Well, Your Honor, what those cases stand for is that there's some type of impediment. That may be a mental impediment, maybe a physical impediment. The impediment here is his lack of understanding of the process. That's what prevented him from acting.
That's part of being a pro se litigant. And those cases cite the pro se status in conjunction with some other type of impediment. Here, the only impediment is that he's pro se. So my question to you again is, can you cite to any case law that says status as pro se is enough to meet either the due diligence or the reasonable excuse factor under the Findon analysis?
I believe the Rushka case is the case in which the woman couldn't speak English. She relied on a layperson's analysis of what she had to do.
Right, but that's in conjunction with pro se having a language barrier.
But I also think that case stands for the fact that a layperson's analysis of what they're obligated to do qualifies as an impediment.
Could I ask you one question? We're setting this up. I know you're past your time, but since I'm the presiding judge, I get this. This is one of the benefits of the job. You know, what bothers me about this due diligence finding and how we analyze that is that if, in fact, we say, oh, you can find that the party was not diligent, but as long as that party can sit on his or her rights or its rights, as long as they hire an attorney, then it kind of starts the clock over again. And as long as that attorney is diligent, then we're going to give that factor to them. I mean, that does not seem to be a very just result. And I'm not sure exactly how you would, I mean, going forward, how we would utilize that dichotomy between the diligence of the party versus the diligence of the attorney. Because otherwise, there's no incentive for these companies to answer. They can wait until, you know, can they get their affairs in order and just hire an attorney, a good attorney, to get in there and save them from their lack of diligence. I mean, does that seem to be a rational way of interpreting that Findon factor? I mean, how would you approach that? And that it makes some sense in going forward. Because are we really talking about what's just?
Right, and the policy of the courts are to have matters tried on their merits. And in this case, the court found that there was an issue with damages, which by itself under 60.02F is enough to vacate the judgment.
But that was a finding by the district court itself. Those damages were found by the district court according to the statute. And I admit, there seems to be an underlying pervasiveness under the subsequent district court's order questioning the damages amount, but that was found by the district court.
Well, it was in a default setting, and it's amounted to 60 times more than she ever earned in the job.
But that wasn't the grounds for the district court. The order that we're looking at here and examining, the court didn't vacate the judgment based on 60.02F.
He cited the entire rule, all A through F.
But he's analyzing the Findon factors, which apply to A.
I'm just...
I mean, there...
He cited the rule of F.
He's not, well, I'm sorry. I'll stop.
Getting back to your answer, it's not that cut and dry. When he learned of his mistake, when he learned of his error, he acted, and that's what the law requires. And he did it within the two-month period of finding out when he couldn't act by himself anymore. And then he got to us, and we acted. We've come within that parameter of time frame to act that Imperial says is legitimate, the two-month, three-month time frame.
All right, thank you. You've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd just like to address a couple of points, Your Honors. First, I think it is important to note that it is the movement's and the fit-in factor's obligation to show all four fit-in factors. Although it can show a weak showing on one factor, it has to then show a very strong showing on the other three. It is Brown's position that, for sure, MSP made no showing of a reasonable excuse, which would automatically require that the motion to vacate be denied. On top of that, I believe there's also no showing of diligence as well. I've talked about due diligence a little bit, but I think that it's important that I talk a little bit more in another way in which I think the court abused its discretion as far as a due diligence factor. I touched on this a little bit, but the court, I do want to acknowledge the court's discretion, but I do want to also acknowledge that a court is required to conduct a review of the entire catalog of events. And the entire catalog of events here is very important, and the court refused to acknowledge or make any analysis on the events that it was presented with. Brown's counsel provided the court with evidence of serious allegations of fraud, fraudulent conveyances. However, the court's order and the court's findings of fact don't analyze these allegations at all whatsoever. It doesn't make any conclusions. It doesn't consider this into its due diligence. And that was an abuse of discretion as well, Your Honor. As far as the damages, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but if you look at Judge Jamie Cork's order on damages, it is well-reasoned, and there is no allegation that anything that she awarded is incorrect. She awarded everything that was entitled to under the law, under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. I know from MSP's counsel's perspective, 60 times more her salary is an abundant amount of money, but however, in that amount is attorney's fees, it's her back pay, her front pay, her emotional distress. This case is a case alleging disability discrimination after she was terminated for having cancer. This is an important, Ms. Brown suffered significant emotional distress, and if you go through Judge Cork's order, it lays out and it describes each analysis as far as the damages.
Is there anything in the order that indicates that the judge dealt with any other reason for vacation other than under the first factor? I mean under.
That's not my understanding. It was under the mistake in 60.02A, and I wasn't aware of anything else, and I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. Thank you.
And is there anything in the record, I should say, too? I limited my question to the order. Is there anything in this record that indicates that the judge dealt with anything other than the reason set forth in A of the statute or the rule?
No, Your Honor, there's not. And I think it is important to take a step back in this case and realize the potential implications that it could have on future cases. The evidence in the record, as I talked about today, establishes that MSP failed to show a reasonable excuse in the due diligence factors, but I also defer to the briefing and how MSP also failed to show the substantial prejudice factor, which I don't have time to talk about today, unfortunately. Nevertheless, the court's order gives companies like MSP a free pass and harms disadvantaged persons like Ms. Brown, who turn to the legal system for relief. The lower court's order encourages companies to ignore the legal process without suffering any consequences whatsoever and encourages judgment debtors like MSP to play fast and loose with their assets and to hide assets during the collections process without any penalty whatsoever.
Are you aware of any case where there's been a division of you know, whether there is due diligence on the part of a party versus due diligence on the part of an attorney that's eventually hired?
I am not aware of that specific fact scenario, Your Honor. I think that the Wilberg v. Beckeris case and then also the Chapman v. Burton case, they're both unpublished cases, Your Honor, but they both deal with due diligence and then the fact that companies only act, or the judgment debtor only acts after discovery of assets that are being taken away from them. I think that's kind of on point there, Your Honor. Like I said, the implications of this case are far-reaching and do not only just impact my client, although the impact to her is substantial. As such, Brown respectfully requests that this court reverse the lower court's order and reinstate the judgment against MSP. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Well, thank you very much, counsel. It was well briefed and argued this morning, and we will take the matter under advisement.